It has been, I think, I don't want to age either one of us. I think it's been 35 years since I've interviewed you. I know. Well, you haven't been returning my calls. I don't know what that's about. Kathy, let's talk about the tour, the acoustic living room shows that you'll be doing with Bill Cooley at Jonathan's Zone of Gunquit on Sunday the 7th. What is it about that format and these acoustic performances that make it not only fun for you as a performer, but rewarding?
I'm not hearing you, and I don't know if I've been cut off or if I'm. It seems like I'm still there.
Nope, we got it. We had a little glitch here, but no, we got everything. Let me talk with you about the voice, and you mentioned it a little bit. It was a couple of years ago that you realized you weren't singing quite the way that you were earlier in your career. Now, a lot of performers would simply maybe adjust songs down into a different key, but you made that decision to go take voice lessons. What was it that drove you to do that?
Well, it's interesting, actually. It came from something, a conversation I had many years ago now with Tony Bennett. And it's the one conversation I've ever had with Tony Bennett. But we were at a gathering, and we were sort of both kind of off to the side. And I asked him, I said, you know, I know how old you are, and I heard you sing tonight. And he was, oh, gosh, he was up in his 70s at that point. And I had never heard anybody that age sing like that. It was amazing. I said, how do you do that? And he just smiled, and he said, well, my voice isn't what it once was, but it's a lot better than it was a couple years ago, and I found a teacher, and I started working again, and I just thought, well, that's, if Tony Bennett can do that, I can probably do this. And that was kind of how it started.
No, I remember back playing songs like Street Talk, Someone Is Falling in Love, right out of the box on that old Blue and White Mercury label. Through your career, you've had so many wonderful songs that seem to be such a great match with singer and songwriter. And I know a lot of that is you, but a lot also the influence of your producer in those early days. Can you talk about the role that Alan Reynolds played in your career?
Yeah, you know, Alan produced all these great records, Don Williams records, and he did Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue for Crystal Gale, and he did, he was kind of this iconic guy. But he wasn't much of a, he didn't make the scene, you know, he wasn't really about the music business-y part of it. He just kind of quietly did his thing. And when I met him, I just fell in love with him instantly, and he taught me so much because at the time I came up, there was all of this question about pop influence and everybody recording digital, and all this stuff was coming around, and, you know, what was modern and what was traditional. And he just kept looking at me over and over again for years, and he would just say, it's the song, pal. It's the song. If you find a great song and you frame it well and you sing it honestly, your work is done, and it will last forever, and it will be timeless if you don't chase what everybody else is doing. And I feel so lucky to have had that influence as a young artist because he kept me from sort of getting caught on every shiny thing that went by.
And is that one of the reasons why those songs from the 80s, the early 90s, they don't sound like a time capsule? They sound like they could have been recorded at any time.
I think that's part of it, yeah. I think he was always looking for the timeless. And he knew what it felt like when he heard it, and we all trusted him. So, you know, we'd keep playing around with something, and then he'd be like, well, that's it. There it is. That's the one. And so you just, you know, there was no... He had this beautiful way of kind of creating a space in the studio where you weren't, like, trying to chase something, or you weren't trying to please him or figure out what he wanted in your head. He just sort of let everybody be themselves, and he would say as little as possible, but what he would say would be something very, very kind of concise, you know, like, you know, what if we think about this when we play this? Or, oh, that was so close, and let's listen to it. And I think after you guys listen to this, you'll know, it'll just, you know, you'll get honed in, and it'll just come out. And a lot of times that was what would happen. The other thing with him that was so beautiful was many, many times the vocal performance that it would be the first time through. I mean, a lot of the records were first or second takes that were very fresh, that we were all just kind of wide open to it. And he had the guts to go with that as opposed to, you know, trying to manufacture something.
One of my favorite performances of yours is a song I always thought should have been released as a single, maybe because of the Main ties, and it's The Wonderful Summer of My Dreams by Main's own Dave Mallett.
Gosh, I still do that song, you know. I still do it a lot. And even in the acoustic living room, we figured out a way that it lives in our set in a new way. And Dave Mallett wrote that song. I always thought it was like a painting in song form to me, like one of those perfect, beautiful paintings. I wish it could have been released as a single too. People still respond to it, and I still love singing it. To me, it's like one of those old Stephen Foster songs or something that just, you know, is bigger than any one moment in time.
We're talking with Kathy Matea here on Downtown. She'll be appearing at Jonathan's on a Gun Quit Sunday, August 7th at 8 p.m. You can get tickets by calling 517-9361 or go online, jonathansogunquit.com. So many hits through the years and a long career, but you weren't content to cruise along on that catalog of hits. What was it that took you back to your West Virginia roots to record Cole, Calling Me Home, and obviously very personal albums? Was it a bit intimidating to take on some of those songs?
Yeah, you know, the Cole album, it happened when it came in through the back door. There was a big mine disaster in West Virginia, and it was before the upper Big Branch one that everybody knows about, but this was before that. Was a couple years before and there were 13 miners. All of them but one died, and they call it now the Sago mine disaster. And there hadn't been something like this in many years, and it took me back to my childhood when I was about 10 years old. There was 78 miners died, and it was a really tough time back home. And so I think when that happened, I was kind of gripped by it, and I was surprised by how gripped I was by it. And for years, I'd had some idea floating around in my head about it. An album that was attached to my roots, my place, but I couldn't make it gel. And somewhere in there, a musician friend said to me, well, you know, Kathy, this is what music's for. I mean, you know, helping us process grief that we don't even always understand. And I thought, maybe that's what I'll do with all this emotion that I feel. I'll make a record about coal mining. And I would kind of bounce that around people that are in my inner circle, and they thought I was like, I don't know, this is probably crazy. And they'd be like, that's so cool. And I had no perspective on it. My biggest fear was that because I didn't grow up, I grew up singing all kinds of music, but there was nobody to teach me those traditional songs, and I was afraid that I would not sound authentic. When Marty Stewart came on to produce the record, I thought, if Marty thinks I can sing these, then I can trust him. You know, So there was a kind of stripping away it wasn't so much about me being a singer. It was more about trying to get out of the way of these songs and letting them come through without a lot of extra stuff being added by me as a singer. And that was a master class in itself in how to approach a song.
You know, I think about you. I think about people like Mary Chapin Carpenter, Roseanne Cash, who were selling a lot of country records back in the 80s and 90s. Country music has changed a little bit, and you've all found homes in the world of folk and Americana and traditional music. And I wonder if in some way that's a little bit freeing, that you don't have to think about genre. You just think about recording good music.
Yeah, I think I was very fortunate because I had a lot of freedom at the record label I was on. So I think I hear people talk about feeling kind of squeezed down by the commercial aspect of things, and I think I got a kind of a freedom that a lot of people didn't experience. So I got encouraged in my musical curiosity, and so that's kind of continued to be a theme. And so it's allowed me to kind of go into a lot of little nooks and crannies, whether it's Appalachian music or Celtic music, or you know, right now I'm messing around with some jazz and some sort of more bluesy flavored stuff, and finding like where the edge is for me, what I can and can't do in those kinds of music, and how to get out of the way in a whole new way. And I think that's what's really kept me feeling like I can still, if I'm going to get on a plane or in a bus and leave my house to go play music, I certainly don't want to just be going through the motions. You know, I want it to be alive and exciting and fun and challenging, and I want to be engaged, and I think that's part of the reason I still am.
You've always been in the forefront of activism, from HIV/AIDS to climate change to arts education, and that includes a lot of appearances as a speaker, a lecturer, and a teacher. Was that a little scary at first to be up there just you without the music, without a guitar?
Well, I always put music in what I'm doing just because it's so much part of my language. So I don't think I ever do any kind of speaking or teaching without using that tool. But, yeah, at first I was like, you know, this thing comes up in me, and I'm like, what do you mean I'm going to go speak about blah, blah, blah? But what I think at the end of the day, the thing that all of those things have in common is really storytelling. And so, I thought, well, if I'm going to speak about climate change, I'm just going to tell my own story about what I learned and how it changed me. And really, at the end of the day, that's the only thing I have that's of any value, and really the only thing that I have that might move somebody else to think in a different way. And if we can, I think that that's really a lot of what music does, and it's a lot of how we resonate with each other. I don't want to try to change your mind. I just want to tell you about something that was very important and inspiring in my own life, whether it's the arts, whether it's, you know, a personal story about, you know, how AIDS has touched people around me and what I've seen. That's I think, a really, really important way that we have civil discussion. I'm not going to listen to you if you're trying to change my mind, but if you tell me an iconic story from your life, that I can relate to. That might open me up to something new, a new way of thinking about something, or at least understanding how you think differently than me and why.
That's great advice, especially in this political season. You've had so many great collaborations through the years, and I was reading recently you did some work with John Prine on his first album in, I think, 5 years.
Yeah, that was a great call to get. Would I sing a duet with John Prine? And as it turned out, I got to sing 2 songs with him. And one of them was an afterthought that's a song I've loved for years that Alan Reynolds wrote called, God bless America. I can't remember the title. But it's one of my I always go back to, there's 2 songs that kind of live in my mind with Alan. One is called Fellow Travelers, and the other one is called Dreaming My Dreams With You. And it's a beautiful, poignant song of breaking up with a spouse that's like, you know, I have to do this, but I will miss you for the rest of my life. And it's so sweet. And a couple days before, I get this email that says, you know that song, don't you? And it was kind of an afterthought, and it was just so sweet to get to sing that with John. And we were in the studio where I made all my hits, Alan's old studio. Jim Rooney was producing, and Alan stopped by, and Tim O'Brien was playing on the sessions, and it was just like old home week. It was just the sweetest thing.
Your songs have been so personal, and part of that is because of the wonderful voice and the sincerity that you bring to them. What's it like to have fans, for so many years, I'm sure, at your shows, talk about their own personal connections to your music?
Well, that's like the ultimate, you know. That's what you really hope to do. I mean, you know, there's the person that wants to back in the day, you know, there's someone who wants to have their picture made with the famous person so they can show everybody back home. And that's one way of interacting with people. And then there's people who want to come and tell you why this song is important and how it touched their lives. That's a person-to-person. That's like, oh, well, I wanted to sing that song because it touched me in a certain way. So thank you for sharing that with me. And now we know what we share in our point of view about this song and why it's important. And to me, that's the thing that is I was always kind of looking for. And so I always used to say, you know, people don't so much want to come have their picture made with me as they want to tell me some story about their life. And that is, at the end of the day, a deeper connection and something that you can't manufacture. And if it happens, you just, you know, you consider yourself lucky to have been able to touch that place that we have in common around the song.
Well, and for me, that song is A Few Good Things Remain.
You know, it's funny, you just said that title, and I thought, you know, that song really, that, I mean, the things that are going on in the world right now, it sort of resonates in a different way. So glad you brought that up.
Well, Kathy, it's a delight to talk with you. Like I said, it's been a long time, been 30-plus years since I've had the chance to talk with you, but it's so great to have you coming back to the state of Maine. Jonathan's on August 7th, and we look forward to the Acoustic Living Room with you and Bill Cooley.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to being up there, especially during the summer. It's just such a sweet place to be. And, you know, there's a lobster up there with my name on it, so I'm just telling you now.
Kathy, before we let you go, can I impose on you to do a quick little liner for the show and just say,
sure.
Kathy Matei, you're listening to Downtown with Rich Kimball?
Okay.
Whenever you're ready.
Okay. Hi, this is Kathy Matei, and you're listening to Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Well, thank you so much. That was wonderful. I apologize for the technical glitches, but it was great talking with you.
No, I'm just glad we got it. I'm glad we got it fixed. That's great. Thank it was you. A pleasure, Rich, really. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much, Kathy, and good luck on the tour, and good luck with everything. Thanks for the music.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye now.
All righty, bye.